Okay, I guess Bobby's not going to chime in. So, all right, welcome to another edition of the First Two Battalion Chief. I'm Danny Sheridan, Battalion Chief from the New York City Fire Department, and we have a very different show tonight. We're going to have a show tonight that has to deal with PTSD. Normally, we talk about tactics and strategies and fires and all kinds of things, but tonight, I have four very special guests, three of who have been on my own podcast, The Invisible Hand on the Fire Ground, and we all have this. Each of my guests has a common thread. They all deal with helping firefighters in need. And anyway, guys, welcome. So I'll let you guys all introduce yourselves. And I just real quickly, I'll tell you about that music. It's kind of a joke. I don't know if people ever get the sarcasm, but you know, we're doing these hardcore fire things, and I got this like kind of like, you know, like Alfred, whatever, Channel 13 book, you know, like waiting for me to like talk about English literature, you know. So anyway, it's as Pete Propillo says, it's a juxtaposition. So anyway, without further ado, I want to welcome my guests. I'll let you all introduce yourself, and I'll just, I think we're going to start geographically. So first, we're going to start with my good friend, Nancy Carbone. Nancy is from New York City, Brooklyn to be exact. I don't know if she considers herself a New Yorker or a Brooklyn person, but anyway. Nancy, want to say hello and introduce yourself?
Thank you so much for having me on. Yeah. Thanks so much. I actually am with Friends of Firefighters, and we provide support to the FDNY firefighters, active and retired, and their families.
Nancy, I think you're being a little modest. You guys do tremendous work.
No, I actually
work.
Think that's it in a nutshell.
All right. I know you're not the leverage, but all right. Well, then we'll move on. I'll move on to Andy Starnes. Andy, you're in South Carolina. You want to introduce yourself, Andy?
Yeah, I'm actually a North Carolina chief, but I'm pretty close
North
to Carolina,
I'm sorry.
So I'll take that.
All right.
That's all right.
I don't know where Charlotte is. I thought it was in South Carolina.
No, everybody gets it mixed up with Charleston. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm from, I work in Charlotte, North Carolina for Charlotte Fire Department. I serve as a battalion chief. I've been there 23 years. I helped with the behavioral health program inside my department and started my own private ministry in 2010, helping firefighters, and first responders find and get help with marital issues, behavioral health issues in general because of my own personal struggles. And I understand PTSD because I currently see a counselor for my own struggles, and I've been blessed to help a lot of other people. Just like an EMT walks a patient to the ambulance, I just show up and get the right people and help them walk into the higher level of care. And we just try to help people get the care they need wherever they are and let them know they're not alone. So that's what we do.
Thanks, Andy. And next I have down in Florida, but originally from Chicago, is Brett Snow. Brett, you want to say hello?
Yeah, sure. How you doing? This is Brett Snow, retired lieutenant from the city of Chicago, and 20 years, a little over 20 years there, and 32 years in the fire service altogether. And I now live in Siesta Key and operate an online counseling ministry and Surviving Life Ministries. And my passion is to help firemen, first responders, as well as their family, understand this job. And I think it's important to understand it. I think this job, as I said before, and I was telling Susan the other day, that this job can ruin every good thing in your life if you don't understand it. And there's a huge battle and tug of war between our personal life and our work life, and we just need to learn to reach an emotional pliability and viability between both worlds. That's an important thing to achieve. And my ministry, of course, is faith based, and I work on I target and prioritize our work and the spiritual health. And I think it's important to, again, know our way of thinking and know what our thought process is at the moment and why it may be that way. And so that's us in a nutshell.
Okay. Thanks, Brett. And next, last but not least, out in California is Sue. Hi, Sue.
Hey, Danny. Thank you so much. I feel like the outlier here. What we do out here, we have a program called First Responders Resiliency. I am a retired paramedic, 30 years on the job, working in both the private and public sector and the fire service, et cetera. And the short story on our program is we train first responders in the physiological impacts of stress and trauma, and we have a proactive program that trains first responders how to avoid the symptoms of post-traumatic stress. Our trademark is putting PTSD out of business because we recognize that everything that's been afforded to most of us is after we begin to have symptoms of post-traumatic stress. So after I got organ cancer and went through a divorce from a fellow first responder, and an initially terminal diagnosis, and a surgeon made a comment about seeing a lot of organ cancer in first responders, and that set me down this path of researching why were we dying and what could we do in advance of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress. And now I work with a team of about 15 retired first responders from every area of the industry. We work with researchers and scientists in universities, and we train first responders across the nation in proactive approaches to avoiding it for themselves and for their families. That's it.
Thank you, Sue. So thank you. So thank you, everybody, for introducing yourself. And don't worry, what I'm going to do at the end, we're going to wrap it up. We're going to give everybody's information and how to get in touch with you guys, because I think this is just such important work. You know, from a personal experience, my own 35 years in the FDNY, I have to be honest, I never heard anything about PTSD. I was in probie school in 1986. We got into the academy in August. I got out of the firehouse in September. And in the first 3 months, I was in 2 flashovers and, how do I describe, witnessed a very horrific accident, fire, explosion. And, you know, I have to tell you, like, in probie school, like, this wasn't even a – no one even talked to us. Like, it wasn't even a thing. Like, you know, like, no one ever said, hey, guys, you know, like, you're going to see things and you may have trouble. And it was just never even discussed. And I had this notion. I went to 17 Truck, right? 17 Truck is in the South Bronx. You know, I get to the firehouse and there's these hardcore Vietnam, Korean – even one guy was a World War II vet, you know. And, like, you have to – there's no way that you're going to show anybody – any sort of weakness, you know. And I remember, I don't know which was the first one that happened. I think it was this, we had a Con Ed explosion. And I knew it was coming. I was in the firehouse. I was in the kitchen where I was supposed to be. I maybe had about a month on the job, if that. Brand new probie. And the lights go out in the firehouse, you know, like a dim. Like they dimmed. And then it came back on again. And then immediately the tones went off. And we go down to, I guess it's called Port Morris. It's down by the, underneath the Triborough Bridge. There's a Con Ed plant. And my captain was a really, really old, salty guy. This guy, Captain Dave. And he was just as tough as nails. And the Irons guy was a Vietnam vet. And here I am, the can, you know, like the new kid, you know. And we're going up to the stairs, and we came across the first guy that, you know, he was blown to bits. He was circling the drain. And then I don't want to be too graphic, but we got up to the fire floor, and I had to put the fire out. And the fire involved one of the other workers in the plant, right? They hit the wrong switch, and they both got blown up. And I remember, like, and I distinctly remember this, the Irons firefighter telling me, like, when we got back to the firehouse, he gave me a big, like, a kind of smack on the back. And he says, you handled yourself pretty good, kid, you know. And, you know, I did not want to let them see me sweat. I was just like, you know what? Yep, I do this. I've done this every day of my life. You know, like, this is just another day in the life, you know. And I remember at the time I had an apartment in Woodside in Queens. And I remember coming home the next night after my shift and, my God, I was just shaking in my shoes. I can't believe what I had just witnessed, you know. And, you know, no one talked about anything, you know. And then not too soon after that, I was caught in a flashover. And then Christmas Eve that same year, I was caught in another flashover. And you just don't say anything. So I see it differently now as a battalion chief. We had a really horrific event back in about 3-4 years ago. It made national news. It was two little kids, like maybe a year and 3 years old. And what happened was the parents were young hipsters, I call them. You know, they came from Vermont or wherever, and they're living in Hunts Point. And the radiator, there was a boiler explosion, and the radiator blew, and the two kids were in the room in their cribs, you know. And the first thing I did when I got on scene was I called the counseling unit, and I said, we're going to need everybody because this was horrific, you know. And, you know, I'm aware of it because I know I've been on the other side. And, you know, I have all these young lieutenants and officers, firefighters. They have all little kids. And this was like devastating. It made like national news, you know. I mean, it was just a horrific event. So that's my own experience. You know, I'm not even going to talk about 9/11. That's just something that's just too big to talk about right now. But anyway, I want to get into the nitty gritty. I'll start with you, Nance. What your group is doing with the FDNY and the Friends of Firefighters, who I have the utmost respect for. I think what you guys do is just phenomenal.
No, thanks, Chief. We're honored to do what we do. It's interesting because you're mentioning jobs outside of 9/11, but we came into being because of 9/11. And very, very early on, I went to a firehouse in the Bronx. I grew up with the lieutenant there, and he said, I need you up at my house. There was a lot of pushback to him because they didn't want any women in the kitchen at the time, certainly but civilian women. But I did get in, and there was a gentleman at the table who you could see was steaming quietly. And he slammed his fist down on the table after about 15 minutes of my talking about how we could have services. And it was early on, and services meaning counseling. And he said, I'll clean up his language. He basically said he didn't want to talk about 9/11. He wanted to talk about the Happy Land fire. Danny, you know well what that is. And this was a fire that killed almost 100 young club goers. There was a spurned boyfriend who set fire to the staircase below that sealed off the entire club upstairs. It was an illegal club. And the damage that was done psychologically to the firefighters on the scene lasted decades. And so this is something that is cumulative. There are firefighters who, yes, they do say that they're there because 9/11 was the tipping point. However, they should have come earlier. Those are their words, not mine. So the job is a very dangerous job, obviously, but I think what is taken into account is the physical danger, but not so much the mental danger. So what we do is we provide counseling. Our main location is in an old firehouse, which over 400 firefighters came on their off time to build over the past 10 years. And it was when we moved into it, it was in private hands for a number of years, and it was a metal fabrication shop, and the firefighters restored it to a firehouse. So they have ownership of it, and that's a key part of this, that when they go for help, they're going to the brothers and sisters that fought fires beside them. That's downstairs. Upstairs, we have the counseling, and we found that formula works very well because when they come in for any event, it could be a breakfast, it could be a dinner, it could be a kitchen talk where we have professional firefighters. Vinnie Dunn is one who's come back several times and talked about things that are very important for the newer firefighters to learn. In coming to that, their guard is let down, they're comfortable, and they're able then to access services. Prior to COVID, we had 7 locations, and we'll get them back up and running, but we did go virtual almost immediately so that we not only did we not miss a session with anybody, we had to hire 2 more and now a 3rd counselor since COVID began. So it's out there. There's PTSD, there's 9/11 cancers, depression, sleeplessness, and then this year we have the anniversary, which is a tremendous trigger.
Yeah. So, Nancy, you mentioned Vinnie Dunn. I know Vinnie, and I know his passion was a result of the 23rd Street fire, and this is when he started becoming obsessed, kind of, for lack of a better word, for building construction and collapse. And Vinny, ironically, is from my old neighborhood. He's from St. Teresa Parish, Woodside, or, you know, in Queens. And we basically lived on, like, on the same block, you know, a few years apart, obviously. But, you know, a question for everybody, actually. I'll throw this question out for everybody. You know, Nancy, you said you hire counselors, but do you guys get better feedback from peer-to-peer, like, you know, other firefighters talking to firefighters, or from professionals? I'll throw that at Sue. So do you get more good feedback from, like, other firefighters speaking to firefighters, or do the professionals actually better at it when it comes to firefighters?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me just make a quick comment. Nancy, that was an amazing presentation. That was so inspiring. And what I would say with been sort of the magic pill for us is that we're all first responders teaching first responders. We do work with trauma therapists, and we absolutely support, recognize, and encourage people to be checking in with counselors as necessary. And, you know, we support that. It's one of the reasons we want to work with Brett. The key for us, and what seems at least the data being collected out of Loma Linda University on our trainings, is what seems to be the real sweet spot is that because we have all of our data and research and science is based out of working with the scientists and the researchers, and then we combine it with all of the experience that all of us have. We're all retired cops, firefighters, medics. It's that peer-to-peer presentation. So we don't do counseling. What we do is we do the science behind what's happening to you, and we talk about how we've learned this, what we do, and because we have that cultural competence, right, or that credibility from being on the streets, we have a real kinship. People really seem to connect on that level. And then what I think in some ways happens is because we provide that foundation, it actually oftentimes softens the spot in the first responder who may have been resistant to getting counseling when we say, absolutely, this is how that can help. And for some of us, what we find is that it really softens their desire to seek more professional help by having that first touch through other first responders.
Yeah. You know, I'll speak from my own experience. I'll tell you that I'm involved with a group of people, you know, it's kind of self-help kind of group, you know, and I would say the first 5 years after 9/11, you know, I know these people very well, you know, for almost now 30 years, you know. And a lot of them, you know, saw me, how I was behaving, and they kept at me. They're like, well, you know, Danny, you got to get some counseling. And I was like, no, what we're doing here is okay. You know, this is good for me. I don't need any counseling. How do you – I'll throw this out to Brett and Andy, because I know myself. Mm-hmm. It's like everything, like even as like giving a mating, there's like this denial thing that happens all the time in every respect. And I'll just talk from my own personal experience that I was in denial for a good 5-6 years. And it took me to hit like a real heavy bottom before I said, you know what, I'm throwing in the towel. I have to talk to somebody about this. Brett, how do you feel about that? Like, it's easier for you and Andy because you're both firefighters. You know, but do you run across this a lot, the denial?
Sure. Well, without a doubt. And I think that even from my own personal experience, it took me well into 25 years in this line of work to realize the negative impacts that this job can have. And something, too, that's also important is to remember that there are a lot of factors that come into play when we're talking about first responders, firemen, paramedics, who are experiencing emotional side effects of this job. And we can't overlook even just our personal lives, because there are people that aren't firemen or paramedics that are experiencing PTSD and emotional issues. And so what we need to also consider is the compounding effect of the fire service and the life over the fire service. And I think, one thing is for me is to help break down these barriers of first responders of that stigma of searching for or needing help as being a weakness. And the other thing, too, that I think is important, and which is one of my approach is to help us understand, and this is something that I carried with me for many, many, many years in this line of work, is guilt. And so we always go through an array of emotions, and whether it's guilt, whether it's anger, sadness, and, you know, frustration, and some of the things that I help first responders understand is that we're not designed to carry our yesterdays, and we're not responsible for the final outcomes of our actions. And through ways of doing that is helping everyone or helping individuals realize what their way of thinking is currently, and why they're thinking that way. Are they feeling responsible for something that happened yesterday? Are they fearing something's going to happen again? And that's important to really help them understand that that it's okay. But we're not responsible. We're not designed to carry our yesterdays and to carry that guilt with us. And nor can we be responsible for not making it down the hallway to get that 3-year-old, because what we are responsible for is taking action, is doing the work and having the willingness to do that. But the final outcome, it's not up to us. And so we need to be able to let go of that and to be liberated from that. And I found, even for my own self, that has helped me tremendously of getting rid of a lot of things. And one thing that really took me down for about 2 years straight was a buddy of mine who I worked with, who took my place on the rig while I went to college. He gets killed 20 minutes later, sitting in my seat, and I struggled with survival guilt for 2 years. I couldn't get past it. I was a bawling mess until I realized, after going to our fire department chaplain, that he helped open my eyes to we're just not responsible, and we're not designed to carry our yesterdays. And it's really helped me change my way of thinking and a belief that I had attached to those experiences, which was liberating for me. And so that's what I want to help others do.
Right. Brett, when we did our show, The Invisible Hand, on the fire ground, I shared with you a story about a woman that I couldn't rescue. And I edited it out because I just didn't want to share it. And
of course.
It's ironic was that this lieutenant at my job, this guy Mike Champo, and we were doing some training on with the FDNY, some remote tactical training, and we were going to Washington Heights. And I said to him, I said, Mike, I said, you know, I had this fire, and I told him the whole story, like I told you that, you know, we were second due, we couldn't get there, we were going up this big hill, the rig just couldn't make it up fast enough. And by the time we got to the building, the people in the street very callously were just like, you know, she jumped already. And I didn't want to take that for an answer because the dispatchers were telling me that she was trapped. And I get up there and I saw the bloody handprint and where she broke the glass and jumped out the window. And here's this beautiful young girl. She was just a mess, a pile in the backyard. And Mike actually knew that he was at the same fire, you know, and I can't tell you, that was after 9/11, but that might have just been like just the straw that broke the camel's back, because I was so twisted over that. I just could not, I could not accept the fact that, you know, that she had to die, because what made it worse was that it was a nothing fire. It was a flash fire. Someone set fire to the base of the stairs. It was a big pile of rubbish and she just panicked, you know?
Right.
I think what, you know, I had been so mocus prior to 9/11 because I've seen so much, like, you know, working in the squad and stuff like that. And, you know, that just broke me. I don't want to monopolize the conversation. So I'm going to turn this over to Andy. Andy, you got me to talk about a story, a training fire I had. But, you know, what's this? How do you feel about that, about guys being in denial? What's your experiences with the firefighters in denial?
Though I'm not just a president, I'm also a client, so I can comment on that one.
Right.
I started
That's a good
my,
line. I like
the
that.
The reason I'm involved in this is because I are one. I am broken. I have been broken, and I've been in a system of accountability ever since that day with a peer support group, an accountability group. I have a virtual accountability group, 12 different firefighters from across the country. We chat like schoolgirls every day, texting. My wife says I talk to them more than I talk to anybody else. And matter of fact, I flew to Jersey for one of his 40th birthday. That's how close we are. And then I see a counselor twice a month. I take an anxiety medicine. I see a pastor. I have a lot of, I'm high maintenance. I take a lot of work to keep me between the lines. But my journey started because I was in denial. I tried to get promoted to driver, and I was on the list every year and didn't make it. My wife said, why don't you go ahead and take the cabin's test? You're studying all the books. Why not? I'm like, no, I want to wait till the 10-year mark. Well, I took it at the 8-year mark, and I got promoted first try. Went to work, had a ball, but I was completely naive, completely unprepared for what the fires outside of the building, dealing with people, and came home for 3 years. I dealt with it my way. And at the end of that 3 years, it started leaking out, and anger outbursts on a one-year-old child and taking it out on her. And I used to make fun of people who had panic attacks, and now I'm having panic attacks. And she pulled me aside and said, I'm not telling you you've got to quit. You got to do something about it because you told me it's the greatest job in the world, and you're not acting like it. You're bringing it home. She pointed a stack of devotionals that I wrote in every day about firefighters who are hurt. And she said, you say they're hurting. What are you doing about it? And she walked out of the room. So I started from that point, and I went to, as your point, what you said earlier, I went to a peer first, not to a doctor, because I want someone who has empathy, not sympathy. Not that a clinician or a psychiatrist or psychologist can't relate, but I want to know that they have actually held a dying child in their arms. I want to know that they've felt the same stress that my family has felt when we didn't have money and I had to work an extra job. I want them to know the difference between a 24, 48, 96-hour shift and then having to go home and deal with life. They can't replicate that through sympathy. It has to be personally involved, intimately involved. That's why the 41 people on our peer support team, I don't just randomly pick someone. When someone calls and says they have an issue, I pick someone who has a similar issue. I asked every one of them when we started, I said, how many of you had formal training? None of them raised their hand. I said, how many have been through something bad? They all raised their hand. I said, how many of you want to help people? They raised their hand. I said, God bless you, you're hired. I can train you, but I can't make you care. And they are divinely qualified, broken, crushed, and qualified. That's the difference. Not that someone who hasn't been through training or who cares and wants to be a part of it can't help. But in my opinion, we have to start with the EMT, then the paramedic, then the doctor. I don't take you straight to the doctor. A lot of times I'm going to turn away from the doctor because I did. Most of the guys will. And these are the responses you hear. I don't want to be viewed as weak. There's a negative stigma. The guys will think differently. I didn't know where to turn. I was ashamed. I didn't want anybody to know. I reached out for help, but they took me off of duty. I had suicidal thoughts. They took me in the hospital in handcuffs in front of me of my peers. I'm going through a divorce. I lost my kids, and I can't afford counseling. Now you got to tell me I got to meet my deductible? My spouse is an addict, but our insurance doesn't cover our family. I'm struggling with anxiety and depression and affecting my work performance, and my boss says if I don't improve, he's going to transfer me off my truck, and this is the only place I can get peace. There's where all this comes from. These things we're talking about, firefighters, police, EMS, they have a sense of identity in everything they do. But the greatest hypocrisy we have, Chief, is that we will go and do everything, sacrifice our lives for someone else, but we won't ask for help or even help the guy in our station if we knew about it. Because just like you said, Chief, hey, you held yourself up there pretty good, kid. You know, counseling was a pat on the back and a cup of coffee and maybe a beer out back before they started testing it, you know. So to me, in order for us to help each other, we have to be trained to recognize it. And what Sue and Nancy and them are doing, I firmly believe that the recruits from day one should be trained to size up their fellow firefighters, not just the building. Because the hardest thing you're going to do as a company officer is deal with the people problems, not the fire problem. Fire is predictable. People are not. You know, if I've learned anything in 18 years of being, you know, with my wife and 11 years of being a dad is I don't know anything about people. You know, I'm yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. I can be right or I can be happy. I have to understand that people will do things that are irrational. They won't make sense. And if I can relate to them and their pain in that moment and just show up and be present, it's not about what I say. It's not about what I know. It's the fact that I care and that I can relate to that pain, and I'm not trying to invalidate them in that moment. And then I can get them to that higher level of care if they trust me. But I got to earn that. And just like you guys and gals here have earned your credibility and your trust, we have to earn that with them, and we can't violate that by breaking their confidentiality or telling them we'll help them and not show up. Sorry for the sermon, but the point being is if we want to help first responders, we have to first be there, be trained, and do not, when they call 911, don't put them on hold. Don't tell them to wait. Mm-hmm. Don't take them off the – we have to respond, period.
Danny, could I comment on that? Can I make a comment?
Sure.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm done. My watch says I need to breathe. Go ahead.
Well, I'd love to just, you know, just having this group conversation is so beautiful. I am sitting outside of a fire department in the Bay Area of California. We are here training this entire department because one of their young captains took his life. And their chief came to our conference and then brought us in to train the entire department. And as Andy was talking,
you're breaking up a little bit,
Susan. Okay, I'm sitting in the same place,
you.
So I'll just keep.
You're good. I can hear you pretty good.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. I was just going to say that when Andy made that comment, I just thought of one statement that we think about all the time: is that departments will spend thousands of dollars training the physical part of the firefighter, the EMS personnel, the police officer, thousands of dollars on equipment and vests and wildland gear and structure, fire. It doesn't matter what it is. We've all got this equipment that we use, and they'll spend almost nothing on the most important piece of equipment any first responder will ever have, and that's their brain and spinal cord. And so the healing work that we do is not on their bodies. It's about how do we get them back to a place of peace and serenity so they can go home and have lives outside of serving in an industry that's eroding them from the inside.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that one of the things the military does is they take their troops and they get them prepared to go home after they've seen that stuff. We don't prepare our troops to go home. And I think what you just said is phenomenal. We need to invest in that. But if you have tips on getting the fire department to spend money on that, please let me know, because I've been fighting that battle for 6 years and I still don't have a budget. You know.
Yeah, we've definitely figured out how to tap into that out here, because they recognize their guys and gals are dying, and we're helping to reduce that disability, that early retirement, and those suicide rates, and just at least of what we can capture on data, is that it's working, and they recognize that, and that, you know, when they can reduce the disability rates, they're listening.
Awesome. You hit them in their pocketbook. Good for you. That's how we get their attention, and I'm all for it. Send me the notes and teach me. I'm all for it.
So, Sue, when I had my show with Sue, I made a comment to her, and I said, Sue, you know, I'm at the point now that I'm so mocus that nothing bothers me. Nothing rattles me. I could see the worst thing, and it's like it didn't even happen. And, you know, and I always kind of felt this way in a sense because, you know, I didn't grow up with the silver spoon in my mouth. You know, my dad left when I was three. My mom was on her own for a little bit. My grandmother was a big influencer in my house. And then, you know, my mom got remarried and she went out of the frying pan into the fire. And it was, you know, so I was pretty much, I always considered myself pretty much self-sufficient. You know, like I relied only on myself. And, you know, I got on the fire department. I think I carried that mindset with me. And then it was reinforced by the things that I saw that I said, well, I can't complain about this, because God forbid I say anything, they'll take my head off and they'll kick me out of the firehouse and I'll wind up in some camp somewhere, you know? So, you know, as now I have 35 years on the job, and, you know, I do see things still, you know, And Sue said to me, she goes, you don't realize it, but it is bothering you physically inside. And I didn't realize that. Like, I just think I'm Superman. Like, you know, I could, all right, I got enough time now. Whatever I see, I've seen it all, and it doesn't bother me. But you actually, Sue, you pointed that out to me, that this is, it still happens. And I wasn't aware of that. Nance, how do you see a difference between the young guys, and when I say young, post 9/11 firefighters to pre 9/11 firefighters, is there any difference in mentality or the way they handle the counseling unit?
Well, it's interesting, and I do want to give a plug to the counseling unit because the FDNY counseling unit is terrific, and they do a good job. And the reason we exist is because some firefighters don't want it on their record in any way. So they were not even going for counseling because of that. So I do want to put that plug in for them. They're terrific.
Yeah, Frank Lito is phenomenal. Yes, he's a phenomenal guy.
Frank's phenomenal. And he's a step-up guy. He's a guy you want to actually, you know, sit and talk with and as a friend. So he gets it. He cares. And it's important to point out that he is on the peer level. Of course, he has his qualifications on top of that, but people go to him because he's a brother. And so that segue into counseling is often the peers. It's often that person at the firehouse who has been through something similar, or someone close to them has been through something similar, and they're the ones that drive people into the counseling. But we have the two floors set up so that firefighters can come in and be with other firefighters, and it is a segue into counseling. It's a feeder, or it's a terrible word, but that's what it is. When they come in and they're comfortable, then when they're ready, they can avail themselves of professional help. But there's nothing like that cup of coffee at the table with someone who knows what you've been through because they've been through it. But that said, the newer firefighters since 9/11, it's a different generation, obviously. Some of them today were in kindergarten when 9/11 happened. So there is a little bit of a detachment in a way. There's a deep respect, of course, for those who have been through it. But they're more apt to avail themselves of counseling services because they don't have that, you know, Danny, when you came on, there was that you find a compartment and you put it in there and you don't bring it home and you don't talk about it. And that was pretty much the firefighters when I started Friends of Firefighters. There was such a resistance to counseling. Ironically, there was a firefighter I met the day after 9/11 named John Sorrentino at a Brooklyn house. He was at a 205, Engine 205. And I asked them what they needed at the house, which was presumptuous of me because I had nothing to give, to be honest. But they said they needed bunting for the house and they needed bugler for the funerals. He knew. And then he said counseling, and I was stunned because it never came to my thought process that firefighters would actually ask for it. But he was ahead of his time, and it took a very long time. It was easy to get the bunting. It was a little running around, but we did it. Bugle, that was easy. But the counseling, I didn't trust the people that I met because I didn't find anybody I would like to speak to until early spring when I partnered at the time with Safe Horizon. We now have our own counselors. Younger firefighters today are much more apt to go to counseling, in my experience, but they're very cautious about the firehouse knowing. They're not resistant like the older firefighters, the 9/11 firefighters. And I do want to add with that, and Chief, you tell me if this is your experience, the people that were resistant 20 years ago have seen their giants, their mentors go for counseling or unfortunately take their lives. And this is a big thing that we've touched on, but it's extremely important. Suicide has gone up. The numbers have gone up. It's a permanent solution to a temporary problem, but identifying these people and pulling them in is really a key goal for us, is to identify who's at risk. And to be honest, no one wears a sign on their shirt. They don't have a special color that points it out, and none of us really know. Well, you know, there was one suicide, the first one that I know of post 9/11, where he was asking everybody how he could help them. I have his last email. We were friends. He didn't come in for counseling. He was helping everyone else, and he went home and took his life. So, the lesson was early for me. You don't know. You don't know unless they tell you. and we have to identify this. And I do think that that spans, yes, there's a cumulative effect with trauma. What someone has come up with in their lives, Dan, you touched on that, that contributes to it, how they're able to process and whatnot. But it's so individualized that you cannot have a crystal ball and say this one, you know, you can identify at risk when you see signs I'm not qualified to see. The counselors see it, and then they make their moves based on that. But we don't know when we have a room full of people who is really at risk. You know, they come to a breakfast, and it might look like the person that is pulled away and in the corner and not talking, but it may very well be the loud one in the middle. So we have to have our ears and eyes open. I think that one thing that's very important, the peers are the road in with first responders, because there's a trust, because they've been through the fires together. And when I say fires, I mean EMS too, the cops too. They've been through down the hallway, they've been in the situations, and they know it. And so there's a trust that lives depend on. And then it, I think it segues into psychologically their lives depend on it. So a long, long answer to your very short question, Chief, is that there is a difference. But at the end of the day, everyone hurts in an individual way. It's all unique, but getting the help is key. And there is a little less resistance from the younger ones, as long as the firehouse doesn't know.
Yeah. I got to tell you a funny story. It's so funny how things happen, right? So about 2 months ago, I don't know why I had to call a division about something, and the firefighter says to me, he says, Chief, we got you on leave right now, some kind of counseling special leave. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He says, yeah, you're on leave or something. So I called Frank right away, and he got back to me and says, Danny, I apologize. He says, I made a mistake. I don't know how I put you on. And that's the first thing I thought about is like, I'm not on leave. What do you mean I'm on a special, you know, counseling, you know, because everyone knows, like, you know, when you have this family, whatever it is, you're on the, you know, you're at the counseling, whatever. And I was like, you know, I was like, no. So he says, Danny, I'll call the division and I'll explain. I made a mistake. And, you know, because I was like, heaven forbid anyone ever would think that I had to take some time off for some personal issues, you know. So,
go ahead.
Yeah. No, you're right. And I understand. But I got so defensive. My guard went right up. He's like, nope, I'm not on leave. So he corrected it. He called the division and whatever. So Brett, how about you? How do you feel? Is it the younger guys or the older guys? Is there one more inclined to be more defensive? Or how's that working for you?
Well, I could tell you this. I've done a couple of research projects over the last couple of years, and I specialize in temperament therapy, and understanding the fact that we all have our unique designs, right? So we all have different temperaments that serves us a different purpose, and there's not one temperament that is exempt from experiencing the side effects of this job. And so one of my research projects looked at, even just outside of temperament, was time on the job. And so what I found was those who developed and who admitted to being diagnosed with PTSD from 0 to 5 years on the job to over 20 years on the job was very much the same. And so when you look at it statistically, for those who are at risk at getting PTSD or suffering emotional side effects of this job, we really can't determine, and we can't say that it's all accumulative, because it can be just one call. And what I found was the same similar percentage of people who were diagnosed with PTSD from 0 to 5 years were the same with those that had greater than 20 years, which I found it to be quite interesting. The other thing that I've been looking at is not necessarily the call or the trauma that is causing a problem. And I termed it mission deprivation. And so I wanted to know, when we're talking about cancer in the fire service, and we're talking about PTSD and those kind of things, not every fire department or EMS service are busy, right? And so I wanted to look at something that could be different. What else And like, you know, Susan and I talk about is a lot of research, the crosshairs are on the same point, right? They're all looking at the same thing. So it's important to kind of move the crosshairs sometimes to kind of look at what we're missing. And one thing I wanted to look at was what's going on in the minds of first responders who aren't going to fires, who aren't going to the traumas, who aren't experiencing these things. And what I found was quite alarming is a lot of the emotional experiences from those who actually experience it are quite similar and have been found in those who aren't doing it. And so it's through the anticipation, it's through the nervousness, it's through the loss of confidence, it's through the worry of not being able to do it, the frustration of being trained and not being able to do the mission. And so I wanted to mention that is we also have to look at those individuals who aren't experiencing these things and what might be going on in their minds and how is that impacting them. You know, going home frustrated, getting mad at your family because you didn't get the fire or you missed the fire or you didn't get the EMS run, you heard someone else going on it. Those kind of things that where your mission deprivation is that it's keeping us or we're being prevented from or deprived of doing the mission that we've trained for and that we've set our minds to do, we've set our hearts to do, but we're not allowed to do it, has a significant negative impact. And I was showing just in the data that a lot of the emotional side effects are quite similar to that experience in PTSD.
Brett, that is first time I've ever heard that. And that is an eye-opener for me. You know what I want to do? I'm going to ask Sue the same question, but I'm going to give an opportunity because I don't know if you – I think some of you have to have a little bit of a time crunch and we're about 45 minutes into this already. So I'm going to give the number out if you want to call in and talk to any of our guests. It's 760-454-8852. And, guys, I don't think we'll get calls because what happens is mostly I think people download this as a podcast now. I don't think we get much live. So, you know, we'll just I'll throw the number out there. I don't see anyone on hold, so we only have you four callers. So we'll just keep moving on. So, Sue, how about you? I know we beat up the millennials, and I don't know. I guess there's a generation after that now. I don't even know what they call them. I'm not even sure what my kids are. They're millennials, right? So, is there any kind of difference between I'm a baby boomer, right? So I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what the names are for. Is there any kind of correlation between, like, I'll give an example. Like, I look at my grandmother. I grew up with her, you know, and she lived through the Depression, World War II. I remember my father-in-law, you know, he was in the Korean War. He lived through the Depression. And, you know, I always thought of those people as just more resilient. Like, they just, you know, they're so tough, you know. And I look at the millennials today, and I feel like, you know, we as the parents, we're responsible that we created these little monsters because, you know, like they can't do anything for themselves, so we think, you know. So do you see any correlation in the generation and the receptiveness to, you know, getting some kind of counsel?
Well, surprisingly enough, you know, I love what Brett said about the mission deprivation because when I first started this company or this program, this nonprofit, about 4 years ago, I thought it was going to be the young ones who were going to be the most receptive because they're a different generation. They really are more aware. There's more access to technology, and we actually are having a conversation these days about behavioral wellness and all of that. But my experience has been, at least from our side, is that the older first responders are oftentimes approaching us and saying, I wished I'd known this 25 years ago. I wished I'd known this 25 years ago. And the young ones are really looking at the older ones to set the stage for how do I handle this, right? We all knew this growing up in this industry 30 years ago. Our philosophy for behavioral wellness was suck it up, buttercup, right? You don't talk about it. You don't feel it. You don't show any emotion about it. And now the younger ones are more receptive than I think just inherently more receptive to the idea of having the conversation. And what shocks me more than anything is that our experience is those with more experience are
so relieved to have this conversation taking place. So because we train in a firehouse, oftentimes we have every age range in there. I do see the younger ones looking to the older ones for acceptance, right? What's the move? But our experience, at least from this vantage point, is that everybody's in because we know it. And I think Nancy made a comment about the fact that, you know, the suicide rates are going up. And that's one of the things that we talk about out here is that if reactive approaches to post-traumatic stress-related symptoms were working, right, if all that we've been doing for the last 30 years or 20 years to help first responders was working, our suicide rates wouldn't be going up. They'd be going down. And I'm not saying that all of those things aren't great in their own right, but we have to have the equipment and the tools for our own wellness prior to getting sick so that when we're doing the industry, I think you said this early on, we're hitting the academies. We're talking to these young ones, even if they haven't been exposed, although everyone has personal history and crisis in their own lives to some degree. We're hitting them early, and we're saying, here's what's going to happen to your nervous system, to your brain, to your body, to your emotions as a result of what you do for a living. Here's some tools. You may not be feeling it now, but a day is going to come, and it's going to be you or someone you know, and here are some tools. So we're just giving them tools to prepare for that, and I think that is a across-the-board gift to every generation.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
I want to get to last, Danny. Let me use this phrase.
Go ahead.
And this is kind of the coverall. If stress is the number one contributing factor to disease, which it is, then reducing the stress, whether it's from running colds or not running colds, is the number one factor in reducing disease.
Mm-hmm.
I see that in other people firsthand who are very stressed out and they're always having medical problems, put it mildly, you know. But, you know, one thing that comes to mind about this whole business about the cultures, you know, is that if you look at the FDNY, and Nancy knows this pretty well, and I'm sure it's same in Chicago, is that it was built basically by the Irish, you know, and
yep.
Myself being of that background, the Irish culture, you don't talk about anything, you know, it's like,
yeah.
You know, there could be an elephant in the room and no one will say there's an elephant in the room. You know what I mean? It's just like, it didn't happen. And everything gets exaggerated in a negative way. Like, you know, if everyone just dies from a heart attack, you know, meanwhile, it could have been cirrhosis of the liver or whatever. So I think that carried over between the Irish and the Catholic parochial school mentality into the fire department. And then you throw in the veterans from all these wars. And then you just had there was no talking about anything. You know, and I now, as someone in charge, if I see something like that I think is going to negatively impact my guys, like I had that two kids got scalded, and, you know, and it happened, we had a really bad car wreck, and there was a baby involved. The first thing I do now is I call the counseling unit. That's the first call I make. I call CSU. And I say, listen, we just had this situation, and, you know, we need some people up here. And that's the culture for me now.
Mm-hmm.
How about you, Andy? Well, is that what you're seeing on your job? You're seeing more receptiveness to getting some counseling, if, you know, especially after a fatal fire or something tragic?
Yes, sir. I see it as you stated, and you've already mentioned in the younger, and I also echo Brett's comments about the difference between a 5-year firefighter and a 20-year firefighter. The suicide rates are also about the same. So, you know, the cumulative effects of stress are there, but our problem, at least within our organization, is we have company officers that don't, I mean, they run the fire department. They are the lieutenants, the captains of this nation are the ones that are running the fire department, not the fire chief. I hate to break it to the fire chiefs out there, but the middle managers are the one taking care of everything. And if a company officer is not aware of these resources or doesn't doesn't call for those things as you do, Chief Sheridan, that you, I applaud you for doing, then you think they're really going to get deployed. You know, the thing that we're blessed with is we have a variety of members on our team from different divisions. So we have people from our dispatch on our team on an app. And if a bad call comes in, that they automatically tell us, hey, engine so-and-so is on a homicide of a three-month-old child. You know, who's available just standing by? And then I start facilitating through the command staff to see if it's needed and what is needed, right? And then if it's certain things are automatic, you know, line of duty death, mass casualty incident, active shooter, they get a critical incident stress team, not just peer support as well. So our members are trained in both. We went through the IFF peer support certification and another one and along with the CISM. But as far as the members asking for help, yes, the younger ones are more prone to, but if they get run into the bureaucratical red tape, whether it's the company officer or the department, what happens after 6-8 months of them trying and they don't get any help? You know, that's my problem is too many departments band-aid them with EAP 6 to 8 sessions to get better of a 25-year problem and don't really do any follow-up. They don't do any peer support or advocacy form, and we have a plan of support that we've borrowed and stole from several departments who are much smarter than us that basically gives them a roadmap to getting back on the job and back to better than they were, but they have support after that, and then they start becoming advocates for it. Some of our greatest team members were people that our team has helped. So, yes, they are seeking help, but are we making it easy enough for them to get them? Because, you know, the number one question I get every week is I don't know where to go. I get that all over the country because I teach internationally, and the first minute and a half of every thermal imaging class I teach is about my own testimony. And if you think God made me a thermal imaging instructor to help people, you're wrong. He made me an instructor so I could tell them about what you guys and gals are talking about today so I can bring them to you or get the right person to get them to you. I firmly believe that because everywhere we go, we share the same message and always one person asks for help, at least one.
Yeah.
So, yes, they are asking for help and they're seeking it, but that's what my focus.
Just recently, I just found this out. There was a lieutenant who was in my probie class and he was involved in a very, very high profile fire here in New York City about 15 or 16 years ago. And I never knew how he died. I thought he had cancer or just something, you know, medical or something like that. And I just found out just very, very recently that he committed suicide. And I was devastated because, like Brett talked about, you know, there was two firefighters who were killed and he took it personally. You know, and I knew him very well. You know, he was in my squad in probie school. And I just never thought that, you know, like he committed suicide. I didn't even realize he was involved that intimately with this fire. But I was heartbroken, devastated that it had to come to that. Like, geez, like if I only knew. You know, I feel guilty over that. There was a kid from my old neighborhood, and it's not fire-related, but I think I found out that him and this other kid were sexually abused by somebody, like in the neighborhood, you know. And they both committed suicide. And I love them both like little brothers. I knew this. And one was a correctional you know, all this whatever it was. So, you know, bull. I wish I could go into the firehouse like someone said, you know, if you had like a tag on you that said like, yeah, I'm hurt. You know, like if someone's bleeding, you know, they're hurt, you know, but how do you tell that someone's hurting on the inside? You know, how do the officers and the chiefs know that their guys are struggling? Like I'm nosy. I have to be honest with you. Like I think I was talking with Andy. Like I have a notebook with every firefighter in my battalion. I have their wives' names, their kids' names. I try to really pay attention to what's going on because this scares the hell out of me. And I know mm-hmm. we're not really running out of time, but we're into this an hour already, and I think, you know, we could probably talk all night. I think some people have things to do. So what I'll do is I'll give everybody an opportunity to do like a quick wrap up, then promote your organization, the website, phone numbers. If you guys want to network afterwards, you have everyone's phone number now. You could kind of co-network, and I'll be at FDIC.
I will not be mad if I'm ready.
Does Sue know that she's talking right now?
No, probably okay. Not.
She has no,
idea that's
that
not me.
She text her. Somebody.
I'm gonna do a quick plug, and then I'm going to let you guys do your wrap-up. I'm going to be at FDIC, and I'm going to be at a booth, number 516. I'm going to have these coins that I got from Dublin. And the company has agreed to anybody that comes to the booth gets a coin. We're going to donate $5 to Nancy's Friends of Firefighters. And I'm also going to have some T-shirts for the 343 ride. And that goes to the Wounded Warriors. So that's my spiel. Hopefully I see everybody at FDIC, booth number 516. And we'll let Sue wrap up first because I think I don't know if she knows that. Can she hear us? So I don't know what she's up
yep,
to.
I can hear you, Danny. That's not me in the background. I think somebody's got a beautiful bride or something back there talking with an open mic, but it's not me.
Okay.
And
so, Sue, let's wrap it up. Let's give everyone your information, how they can get in touch with you, any other things that you want to talk about. Just here's your chance.
Okay. Well, you know, I'll tell you what. Our website is the word resiliency, followed by the number one, ST. So it's kind of a play on words, resiliencyfirst.org. People can go
yeah,
on
how
there.
How do you spell resiliency?
No one
knows how to spell it,
though. Actually, super complicated. I'll do it for you. It's resiliency. So resiliency1st.org. And here's what I would say that is probably, for me, kind of the wrap-up on all of this, as you just said this. How do we know who's hurting? You know who's hurting because they're in uniform and they're standing in the department. And the truth is that, as we talked about with you, Danny, that it's the older generation that has gotten desensitized to the physical and emotional impacts of the work. But as the book, The Body Keeps the Score, will tell us, is that your body, your nervous system is still absorbing all that energy, still absorbing all those impacts. Even though psychologically you're telling yourself you're okay, the rest of your system is still absorbing all of that pain. And so talking, making this an open conversation, as Nancy has alluded to, is that making this a safe conversation out here. Certainly, we can't lose our jobs if we talk about it. Post-traumatic stress has become a presumptive disorder in the fire service in California. But it isn't that we want people to be able or to want to go out on disabilities for this. We want people to know how to calm their nervous systems, get a sense of homeostasis and serenity so that they have tools to calm themselves down when they're under stress, how to discharge some of the energy of these horrifying calls that we all run, and how not to let that trauma store in your body and in your mind. And the last thing I'll tell you is that the pivotal comment to me was when they took out half my kidney with that tumor and said, we see a lot of this in first responders. And that's when I knew we were becoming physically, not just psychologically and emotionally, but physically sick because of what we did. And those things can be prepared for. They can be mitigated. And you do not have to get a disorder. And here's my only stand on this, and then I'll stop my part of it, is we believe out here that post-traumatic stress is not a disorder. It's an injury. Just like tearing your ACL or your shoulder, it is not a disorder. Schizophrenia is a disorder, and you have to be medicated for life for it. But post-traumatic stress symptoms can be treated, and you can recover from that. You know, how well you recover and how bad your trauma is all unique to each individual. But we believe that this is not a disorder. It's an injury, and it's something we can work with. So that's why our trademark about putting PTSD out of business, we really want to remove that title, that people feel like they're permanently broken because of it, and the thought that
there's something wrong with them, and there's nothing wrong with you. Just like you treat a fire, they're near their shoulder. We have a brain strain, and that can be treated.
Great words, Sue. Thank you. Awesome. Because yes, I think you're right. I think thank God that the stigma is now being taken away from all this, and it's now, you're right, it is an injury, because, you know, think of all the things we're exposed to, right? So.
Yeah.
Let's go now down to Florida and let Brett wrap it up. This is,
You got it. So, yeah, Brett, no. So, website is, Surviving Life Ministries is the ministry. The website is sl-ministries.com. And again, it's, To follow up on what Susan was saying too is prevention. You know, prevention and stress, and that's a huge thing. I studied cancer biology in fire service for 3 years, and stress is a major precursor for not even just cancer, but for a lot of metabolic disease and issues that we have. And there's one thing that I want to mention, and this is what we're battling, especially in the fire service, like they were in war, is a saying basically by Viktor Frankl, who was a psychiatrist, and he survived 3 different concentration camps, and he's now a psychiatrist, but he said abnormal response to a abnormal situation is normal behavior. And he was looking at suicide. People who were in these conditions committing suicide was deemed to be now normal behavior in those situations. Now you look at the fire service and you take that and you flip these around, and you say normal response to an abnormal situation is abnormal behavior. And that's from the fire service, meaning that it's normal to run out of fires. It's normal to avoid danger. But as firemen in the fire service, we are conditioned and trained to go against our human nature. To now being coming out of fires or not wanting to go in is deemed abnormal. And so we are fighting this human nature and going against it and pushing past that line, which is one thing that I believe is causing a lot of our issues with our way of thinking. And so that is one of my biggest goals is to certainly help change our way of thinking and develop emotional pliability and viability and reduce the stress. And Susan, I'm with you.
Thank you, Brett.
Thank
yeah,
you.
I do agree. That stress, I see it firsthand in people very close to me and how it has medical ramifications, without a doubt. Andy, you want to give us a quick wrap-up? I don't think you have a website, but if you want to just give us some parting words, it'll be great.
Yeah, I have a website that's not to do with that, so I won't be talking about thermal imaging for PTSD. So,
right.
I would rather point to the work that's already being done by these professionals. Check their websites out, check out their resources, and I would encourage every firefighter, police officer, first responder to do something that's completely uncommon for most of us, which is go get training on the soft stuff. We're good at the hard stuff, but go get training on the soft stuff, and just like you would when you pull up on an incident, You know what you do. You're not consulting your tactical guidelines in that moment. You know what to do based on the situation. The conditions drive the tactics. Well, how well are you trained to talk to your own people about these tough subjects? I have firefighters who would rather take a 2.5 up to the 3rd floor by themselves than sit down and talk about suicidal ideation or PTSD or anxiety or depression. They ran away from it. I mean, they won't deal with it. They want someone else to do the work, and I'm going, you're wrong. You're the one that should be doing the work. They want you. They need you. It's like a parent shirking their responsibilities of taking care of their child. I would highly encourage that, and look at places that are first responder or firefighter-based, like my friend Dina Ali at North Carolina First Responder Peer Support, Blake Stinnett at the Next Wrong Code Green campaign, lots of great sites out there that direct you to professionals like that are on this call tonight. I am nothing more than a messenger, and I'm trying to tell you and everyone out here, if you want these programs that you're preaching to be a success, you've got to have more messengers that reach them and bring them to you, because they're not going to go, as you said in the beginning, you have a resource inside of a firehouse. Why? Because they feel comfortable. They feel at home. They're not going to go in a place that is, you know, clinical based without feeling at home. You've got to get them past that. So let's not have firefighters turning away from care. Let's bring them to care, and let's not neglect the greatest rescue we can ever make, which is one of our own. So thank you for your time and for sharing and keep up the great work.
Thanks, Andy. You know, it's funny you mentioned Dana. She was in New York recently, about a week ago, and she rented a bike, and her and I took a bike ride from my firehouse, and I rode with her up to White Plains, and she took the train back. But, yeah, I just saw her just probably about a week or two ago. So anyway, that leaves us with Nancy. Back to Brooklyn.
Back to Brooklyn. First of all, Keith, thank you so much for the opportunity to be a part of this. And Sue, Andy, and Brett, boy, it's wonderful to hear what it is that you're talking about, because it is so familiar, yet you brought some things out tonight that were important for everyone to hear. I think the most important thing is to get the word out to the members that the help is there. We're increasing our hours from August 15th till October 1st. We'll be open weekends. We'll be open till 8 p.m. It's very important that the firefighters and their families know that there will be peers at the firehouse and ready to be there with a hot cup of coffee. And no, I will not make it, so it's safe to drink. My coffee has a very bad reputation, deservedly so. Chief, I want to thank you for the coins, because the Dublin Fire Department did talk to us about producing them and selling them on our behalf. And everything that's donated goes straight into the counseling rooms. Or we have acupuncture, biofeedback, heart math, yoga, anything that gets the firefighter and the family member in the door so that we can help them. So I thank all of you for your work and for your inspiration. And we're hopeful that the firefighters out there that are hearing this will just reach out. And whether they want to reach out to be a peer or they want to come in for a cup of coffee, I think Sue, Andy, Brett, and I welcome them, and we're here.
Thanks, Dan. So one final plug. So if you're out FDIC, I have coins from the Dublin Fire Brigade. On the other side, it's a 20-year anniversary for the – it's a beautiful coin. I'm going to put it up on my website, on my Facebook tomorrow. And if you come see 3 a.m. Innovations, they're being sponsored by Microsoft. It's like right in the main aisle in FDIC. I'll give you a coin if you come by and say hello and meet these people from 3 a.m. They're nice enough to sponsor the coin for the Friends of Firefighters. And I said each coin that we give out, $5 goes to Nancy. And also I'll have some shirts there for the Wounded Warriors. So I'll have about 100 shirts with me. My last closing thought is, you know, I've been around for a little bit, and, you know, now being on the other side of the coin, I encourage everyone that's listening, if you're even a firefighter, you know, if you see your buddies are struggling, don't be afraid to give them a hug or, you know, just tell them, hey, listen, man, take care of it. Because, you know, I remember I was a captain. You know, I had guys coming to the firehouse going through divorces and all kinds of money problems. And I used to keep an eye on them. And as an officer, as a chief, even as a fellow firefighter, I think we have to be a little nosy, because, you know, it's not acceptable anymore to just to say, you know what, yeah, let's have after work, we'll go out and have a few cold ones and we'll just shake it off. This is real stuff, as y'all pointed out. So I really... I can't thank you guys enough for taking an hour out of your very busy schedules to be with me. If you could all just text me your website, because I know it was a little blurry, I'll post them on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And this way we have a permanent record for the for your guys' information. So, again, with that, I'm going to let you guys go. I'm going to hang up on each of you. Thank you again for being here. So I'll say goodbye to California first. So how do I do it? You know, I think there's a gremlin in my computer. I really think someone took over my computer. It's like, this is crazy. I have no control of my computer right now. It's like very, very strange. Some strange things happen.
Thank you so much, Dan. Thank you for this opportunity.
today my daughter got a FaceTime call. It said dad, and she's like, the guy had a white shirt on and a little guy. And so I don't know what's going on. Now my computer is gone. So I don't even know how to end this thing.
Yeah, I
think
I think you better work
this
on that one. That doesn't sound good.
Someone's having a lot of fun with me right now because I can't even this is crazy. I can't do anything. This is like my computer just froze up. So why don't you guys do me a favor? Why don't you just say goodbye and hang up, and then I can just end it.
Yeah.
All right, good night.
Thank you all.
We love you.
Thanks,
bye,
everybody,
okay.
For me. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Dan, for the opportunity. And Andy, I want to say it's good talking to you. I didn't realize that was you at first. So, all right, guys.
Thank
good night.
You.
Thank
good
you
night.
All.
Appreciate all of you.
You got. Yep.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Hi, all. Thanks for being here tonight on the First Stu Battalion Chief. I apologize. We had some technical difficulties at the end. I want to thank my guests, Andy Starnes, Brett Snow, Nancy Carbone, and Sue Ferrin. I'll be posting their websites on my social media, and I think they do great work. And if you're having trouble, please, please, I implore you, get to somebody, talk to somebody. Don't go this alone, because this is serious business. I'm losing too many friends to this suicide stuff, and I think enough's enough. So until next time, please be safe, and we'll see you again at FDIC.